This is Lena Live. I'm Lena Mirmont.
Special guest, Professor Jenny Brand Miller from University of Sydney in Australia. And I have to say that it is a strongly unique opportunity not only to have such a brilliant scientist from another part of the world, but to discuss extremely relevant issue which has to do with our health, our diet, some medical issues which we can correct with the diet, and particularly with the emphasis of research and accomplishment which Professor Jenny Brand Miller was focusing and became one of the most important and accomplished figure in this area. And the area is a understanding of glycemic index in carbohydrates. And to make it a little bit more simple in everyday language, it is a understanding how our carbohydrates world can impact our health, where it is very beneficial and where it is indeed harmful. So I'd like to invite to our discussion my very special guest, Professor Jenny Brand Miller, whom we are extremely grateful for her finding time and will sharing and will share her knowledge on those areas. Jenny, welcome. And I'd like very much to ask you to give us just a big picture of your research, your findings, and then we will focus on your book, which has to do with glycemic index.
Okay, thank you very much, Lena, for having me on your program. I'm delighted to be here. I'm in Sydney and it's the morning, and I know it's the evening where you are. My research has been all about the carbohydrates in foods. It's a controversial subject because of its relationship to weight loss and diabetes and the management and prevention of chronic diseases such as cardiovascular disease, stroke, and heart attack. So what we've been able to show over the last 30 years is that carbohydrates are a mixed bag. And some of them are good for you and some are not so good for you. So I think the message is you do your body a disservice if you avoid carbohydrates altogether. The real challenge is to pick the right ones. And I hope during our program today that I can help to do that.
And I also wanted to mention that the power of your research is extremely comprehensive because it stretches from really most prominent diseases in our society, like diabetes 1 and 2, obesity, which we know leads to high blood pressure and heart disease. It is also has to do with a disorder in ovarian function. So those are quite scaring issues are forcing us to pay attention to this incredibly helpful research and conclusions you came to. So we are going to concentrate in your book, which called the new glycemic revolution. And I like to ask you if perhaps you can give us a picture of the process, what really happening with blood sugar, with the reaction of the body when we absorbing these carbohydrates, because there are different groups. So I will give you absolute freedom to start, whether from positive or good carbohydrates for us, and then perhaps to give us a difference of assimilation to our body if we will take some negative carbohydrates, which provoke very quick rise of blood sugar and then other negative consequences of it. So perhaps we can start with the first group and say what is the positive and powerful group of carbohydrates with a positive and good glycemic index.
Okay. Well, perhaps your listeners might like to know what a carbohydrate is first, Lena.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so carbohydrates include all the starchy foods, the potatoes, the breads, the breakfast cereals, the rices that we eat. Many of the low-fat snacks we eat are very high in carbohydrate. They also include the sugars that we eat, and that includes the naturally occurring sugars that are in fruit and fruit juices and milk, for example. And it also includes the sugars that we add to foods, such as refined sugars. So it's a mixed bag of carbohydrates. But don't make the mistake of thinking that this is an argument about starches versus sugars, because it's not. What we've found is that many starches and sugars are actually quite slowly digested and absorbed. And these are the ones that are good for us. These are the ones that cause only a gradual rise and fall in blood sugar or blood glucose when we eat them. So gram for gram of carbohydrate, these carbohydrates just take longer for the body's enzymes to digest them. And that's in their nature. It has something to do with nature's packaging, we call it, nature's original packaging. And it also has to do with the extent to which us human beings, the food industry, has cooked them, processed them, puffed, popped, flaked, you name it. When you do those things, when you process a food, you can make the carbohydrates very easily digested and absorbed. And that makes them more likely to raise blood sugar to a level which is, in the short term, perhaps not a danger, but over the longer term, it does damage to many tissues in the body, including the heart vessels, the vessels in the heart and the arteries. It does damage to the eyes and the kidneys and to the cells that produce a hormone called insulin. And those cells are in our pancreas. And when they begin to fail from overwork, when they begin to fail, that's when we have a diagnosis of diabetes. So, Lena, I can tell you some examples, if you like, of low glycemic index. These are the foods, low glycemic index foods are the ones that are digested slowly. It includes foods, surprisingly, like pasta, the legumes, the beans, and things like lentils and soybeans. It includes many of the fruits, some breads, some breakfast cereals, some rices. We don't know unless they've been tested for their glycemic index. You can't guess, really. Perhaps an approximate guide is the extent to which they've been processed. So something like oats that have been steel cut to make into a porridge, quite thick and coarse, they'll have a low glycemic index. But something like instant oats or porridge, which cooks in oatmeal, which cooks in a minute, that will have a high glycemic index. So unfortunately, many of the foods that are on the supermarket shelves these days, even ones we consider to be whole grains, they can be quite quickly digested and absorbed and therefore raise blood sugar quite high, and therefore they're high glycemic index foods. So a message is that you need to know which are which, and the only way of knowing that is having them tested And the food industry has been good about that. Many food companies have had their products tested. And you can look up the values, the glycemic index, on a scale from 0 to 100. You can look up that on our website, which is glycemicindex.com.
I have to thank you particularly because the way your book is written has this almost invisible balance because, yes, it is for professional people who are on your level of expertise and understanding of physiological connections between human body and absorption of the food. But it's also extremely transparent. It has this crispy clarity because one who doesn't know anything about this relationship and this concept could relatively easily to understand what you're talking about, but also can use this on a daily basis. By the way, I have to apologize because I called your book A New Glycemic Revolution, which indeed it is the new glucose revolution. I know I didn't change the content of it, but this glycemic index became such a prominent vocabulary in my mind while I was reading your book that my apology for not titling your book properly, but as I said, the content is certainly exactly the same. So coming back to points in your book, which indeed very clearly identify the difference between certain kinds of carbohydrates, I just wanted to make it clear that people can mistakenly say to themselves, well, I digest very quickly certain foods, and word quickly can be misinterpreted because quickly doesn't mean necessarily good. Quickly in that particular research and your conclusion means that the blood sugar will go very quickly high and energy will be very shallow, very disturbing. In fact, it will create more of a hyperactivity rather than a gradual, profound building up energy in the body. So I just wanted to make sure that we understand that digesting food quickly, not to be mistaken with a problem with a building up quick sugar response, and actually wonderful digestion of a slow building up sugar level in the body, which can be only with a wonderful carbohydrates quality with a lower sugar index to it.
Yes, Lena, I think that is a really good point to make. We don't want our blood sugar to rise quickly. It's like a roller coaster ride when it happens. It surges, the spikes in blood glucose. They challenge the body's mechanisms of bringing blood glucose back to normal. So it's really quite critical that blood glucose stays within a quite narrow range, and our body has hormones and cells that are dedicated to bringing blood glucose back to normal after a meal. So in the case of someone who has type 1 diabetes, that happens when those cells, they're called beta cells, they completely fail. And that means they need insulin every day or every meal, or they will die. So it's a very important set of cells, the beta cells. We've got to look after them. They don't like these spikes and surges in blood glucose. They like a gentle rise and fall. And I think another message is it's don't take away this idea that it's you may as well avoid carbohydrates altogether. Because these cells do need to be fed. They are cells that need glucose to maintain what we call our insulin sensitivity. If we take away the carbohydrates altogether, it leaves us just with fats and proteins, And having just fats and proteins is another challenge for the body. So we've got to have this balance between carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, and we need to consume the high-quality versions of each.
Perhaps we will be a little bit jumping in between different chapters of your book, but the conceptual continuity, I'm sure, will not suffer. And I will permit in my own questions and perhaps comments to have this a little, illogical jumping from one chapter to another. But I just wanted to make certain points, and they will be touching different chapters at the same time. You just, in fact, answered quite a bit. One of the chapter what's wrong with today's diets, and you just answer that with bringing up very important point of the balance between sugar world, carbohydrates and protein. And I would say that this is so incredibly critical for the children. In fact, my first enthusiastic reaction towards your research was because I'm facing everyday children who are truly suffering from these balanced diets. Unfortunately, parents are not very well aware of it. And as I mentioned to you in my, I believe, maybe initial letter, I'm extremely concerned because unless the parents will be more educated, we're going to have even greater army of a future generation with obesity and all these diseases which we already mentioned. The quick sugars is almost like an addiction, and it's very hard to conquer because children have this taste. They are rising in quick energy very, very successfully, but then they're getting extremely tired and all the immune system gets deprived. I like to ask if you have some suggestions how this approach and where is a particular emphasis on the diet should be with the children's age, let's say just starting from toddlers and going up to teenagers.
So starting with what age group, Lena?
Toddler age, I would say, like after 1 year old. Once they started to move and have these physical activities where they have a greater need for outside food, when they are stopping developing from breast milk or bottle food and they started to chew and they started to have this ability to digest the normal good food. Yeah. How would you recommend to the parents whom I'm going to deal with after I'm having this wonderful conversation with you, what kind of a message I would be able to deliver and share with them according to your experience?
Sure. Well, I think it starts with the pantry. If it's in the pantry, it will get eaten. So if you don't want your children to eat a lot of a certain food, then don't put it in the pantry. You know, by all means, have it when you're out. And so I call those special foods, indulgence foods. So things like cakes and biscuits and soft drinks, they're party foods to me, and they're not, they don't belong in an everyday pantry. So I say to my children when they were small, I said, we'll have those foods when we're at a party or when we're outside, and particularly in the context of being active, playing as a family in the park and walking and doing active things. That's the occasion where you can afford to eat these, what we call energy-dense extra foods. But in the pantry, I would start by saying, well, children should be either drinking milk or water when they're young. You can add some flavoring to the milk. That's okay if that's the only way they're going to drink the milk. I'm pretty pragmatic. I know that children like to have a little bit of flavoring in their milk, and milk is such a good food. I think it's better to have a sweetened chocolate milk than it is to have no milk at all and have soft drink instead. Okay?
Yes.
So you call it soda. So when I say soft drink, I mean sugar sweetened fizzy drinks and sports drinks and energy drinks and things like that. So those are fairly high glycemic index foods, whereas milk and even sweetened milk like chocolate milk has a low glycemic index. It's about 30 on this scale from 0 to 100. And whereas soft drinks are double that, they're 60 to 70. And that's the same as a piece of white bread, for example. So they both, a white bread and a soft drink, have approximately the same glycemic index, or GI, as we say for short. So I give my kids, when they were small, I was giving them fruit cut up, and I think you can do fun things with sliced fruits. You can make funny faces and things. They cut them up so that they're easy to eat, and that includes vegetables, sticks, carrots and celery sticks and things like that. And I'd make sure that the plates look colourful, and at least half of the plate is covered with fruit and vegetables. And the other quarter of the plate, I'd make sure there's some protein. The protein foods are things like meat and fish and tuna and eggs. And they've been overlooked in recent years. But we're finding that protein intake should be higher rather than lower, to ensure that children feel satiated, feel satisfied after the meal. It makes them feel fuller for longer if there's a decent amount of protein in their meal. So, you know, I'd encourage children to love the flavors of things like canned salmon and canned tuna, because they're not only sources of protein, they're sources of those very special fatty acids that are incorporated into the growing brain. So, and they're not expensive. Same with eggs. You can buy special, they're called body eggs in Australia, that have these special fatty acids in them. So, and finally, the other quarter of the plate is your sort of starchy food. And this is where we look carefully at the glycemic index, particularly careful. So we look at, it might be pasta, it might be the beans that we can put there. They're both low GI, the lentils and the chickpeas. Things like peanut butter have a low GI. I know we have to be careful about allergies these days and the risk of choking on peanuts, but nuts are, in general, nuts are really good foods to incorporate into children's diets. We just have to watch carefully that they're not allergic to them, and that minimize the risk of choking. The other protein sources are things like fish and lean meat. Lean meat means meat that you've cut the salvage fat, that you can't see a lot of marbling. You want it to look, if it's red meat, you want it to look basically red. And that's a really rich source of micronutrients. And that's, we don't want to avoid them. There's a big difference between limiting something and avoiding something. There's a happy balance there. So it's about having high quality proteins, carbohydrates and fats. So for the parents, I know it's difficult, it's confusing, but I guess as a general rule, if it comes in a packet, you want to know that it's low glycemic index or high glycemic index. If it comes in nature's packaging, where nature's packaging means, you know, that nothing's happened to it between the paddock and the plate, except you've cooked it or prepared it in a way that's suitable for eating, then we don't need to worry about the glycemic index. It's something you can encourage the children to eat.
This is a wonderful clarification, and certainly you gave such a fantastic scale of possibilities. I like to be clear in one thing and see if you agree with me. I believe that that balance which you're talking about between protein and carbohydrates is extraordinarily important because if you have enough of a protein, and what does it mean enough? It depends, of course, what kind of a protein and age of the child. But if it is certainly enough with amino acids, then the craving for something sweet will be greatly diminished. And the problem, for example, in the United States is that we see these hamburgers and French fries, which becomes almost like a prize because you can see the child will nibble on potatoes and there will not be much room left for the hamburger, where indeed it should be reversed. So I don't know if you would agree with me, but I feel that a parent should be shifted towards indeed priority of the protein first, and then to have as an accompaniment, but not as a predominant quantity in a meal, of the carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. The quantity is clearly something that is hard to judge. I think if we're a parent, then we have to be guided by the child. It's really never appropriate, never, to insist that a child finishes everything on their plate. It's never appropriate to force more mouthfuls into their mouth so they'll have a good night's sleep. It's something we should be guided by the child. Excuse me, I'm just going to clear my throat.
Please do so. And while you're doing this, I wanted to add something else. I think that this dessert idea, which you described so clearly with having something outside of the house, not to keep things on the shelf, that will really bring the psychological habit for this child who will not even imagine just to grab frivolously either a piece of candy or cookie. So that selection for the everyday food will be built in the child's mentality. So later on, it will not be such a big a problem. I have to tell you that I have one particular child who is in a totally different extreme. This child has such enormous allergy, and that's what I wanted to ask you next question. A poor little boy, he's allergic just to about everything. In fact, he's overly disciplined because we have this tradition to have a little bit of a juice after the class. And, of course, I never would offer a juice with added sugar, but the juice has natural sugar. So he would say to me, and he's a 5 years old, he said, just a little bit. And I am totally mesmerized to what extent this child already knows his own limitations, restrictions, and frankly, it is quite a psychological burden. So we do have a tremendous amount of allergies. You already mentioned one well-known with the nuts. I personally believe that this is partly because of the processed food, because added chemicals, and because a lot of food losing its enzymes and natural properties, which used to exist many centuries ago. So we're depriving our own absorption. But coming back to this allergy situation, in your experience, are there particular allergy reactions parents should pay attention to?
All right. With true allergy, you are dealing with a protein fraction in the food, That's a true allergy to that protein, and it causes what we call an immune response in the body. And that immune response includes a lot of reactions that are clearly distressing, such as hives and vomiting and diarrhea. I think it's important that allergy is properly diagnosed. A lot of parents are self-diagnosing allergy when it's probably not true. It just happens to be coincidental with maybe some kind of gastrointestinal infection. So we need to go to the experts to have a true diagnosis of a food allergy. Because, as you say, otherwise the diet will be highly restricted and a lot of psychological burden on the child and the parents if there is a true allergy. The next thing to say is that children grow out of true allergy as well. They might be allergic to, eggs or cow's milk allergy. They might be at 1 year old, but by 2 years of age, they have grown out of that. And so it's important that we keep ensuring that we're not unnecessarily restricting food in children with allergies. So I guess my message is that only a small fraction of children, maybe 5%, 1 in 20, have a true allergy. And yet you probably are coming across 1 in 4 parents who say, oh, my child's allergic. So I think in many cases that's not a true allergy. They might be talking about something called lactose intolerance. Lactose intolerance is very common after the age of about 3 to 4 to 5 years of age, especially in certain ethnic groups, Asians and African Americans. A lactose intolerance is something that is a genetically inherited trait. It's very common, and it means that they will get gastrointestinal symptoms when they ingest lactose. But the good news is that there is no lactose in cheese. There's no lactose that causes problems in yogurt. Yogurt does have lactose, but it also has the enzymes that are responsible for digesting the lactose. So children with lactose intolerance can still have yogurt. And I think yogurt's a really good food to encourage children to eat.
I have to remind to our listeners that I have truly unique opportunity to speak to Professor Jenny Brent-Miller, who is professor of University of Sydney in Australia, who indeed already have her workload being on Tuesday when we are still here in America on Monday. And this fantastic scientist is ahead not only on time and her geographic position, but she's very much ahead in understanding what can trigger some major diseases in our society, like diabetes, like heart problem, some hormonal issue with polycystic ovarian syndrome, and some other issues which has to do with the assimilation of blood sugar, which we called a glucose. She wrote a number of books. They've been translated, Jenny, either in 7 or 12 languages. Forgive me, I don't remember exactly the numbers, but the fact is that it has very prominent international position, and we are very eagerly learning from you how to appreciate the food we eat and to make it in a little bit more simple everyday language. We have to understand and to be more aware what kind of carbohydrates are good for us and which one are not so good. And my next question will lead to the issue of maximum performance. That's again area which I'm extremely interested in, dealing with the psychology of performance. And of course, diet is a such incredible fuel for the performance. It gives us mental fuel, emotional energy, and as a combination, it produces the maximum success in our performance. So I would say that in your chapter, in your book, I believe it's in the third part of your book, where you're talking about weight, diabetes, hypoglycemia, heart situation, and a sport and a peak performance. I think that would be very appropriate to discuss right now, and to see your points, how we can indeed maximize our performance.
All right, so you're talking about both physical performance and mental performance.
Correct.
So let's talk about physical performance first. So we're talking about sporting events, as well as, you know, you're still what we call weekend warriors, people who just want to do you know, sufficient exercise for their health, and they enjoy things like hiking. There's also occupations where physical performance is critical, like firefighting and rescue operations, where the people involved might have to go for quite a long time without food. So what they have before the event, what they have during the event, and what they have after the event are all separate questions. So before, during, and after. And what we've done in Australia, and some American scientists as well, is look at whether a carbohydrate that's slowly digested and absorbed gives an advantage to the athlete compared to a food that's quickly digested and absorbed. And we tested this in the context of what we call prolonged strenuous endurance exercise. So prolonged means it goes for at least an hour and a half. Strenuous means that you're going at least, on a scale from 0 to 10, you're going at least 7 out of 10. You're going quite hard. And that means that you're using your blood sugar, you're using the carbohydrates stored in your muscles as your source of fuel for those muscles. You're burning carbohydrates, you're burning glucose. So the question we asked was, well, is it better to have a surge in blood glucose, or is it better to have a sort of sustained source of glucose entering the bloodstream from the gastrointestinal tract? And what we found was that strenuous exercise was prolonged. It was extended. People could go for longer at the higher pace if they had a low glycemic index carbohydrate as their pre-event meal. So we tested lentils, and that was the low glycemic index food, and we tested potatoes, and that was the high glycemic index food. And what we found was that with the lentil meal, the athletes were able to perform 20 minutes longer at a very high pace compared to the high glycemic index meal. And that was repeated by other scientists around the world. So that's the first message. Low glycemic index foods, if you're doing prolonged strenuous exercise, so if you're doing a marathon or an Ironman event, we call them here, if you're doing a very hard game of football or tennis that goes for hours, then the pre-event meal should be low glycemic index. But maybe there's the opportunity to drink during the event, and that's why we have all those sports drinks. And it has been shown that those sports drinks are helpful. They provide carbohydrate to the working muscles. They provide it quickly. They give the muscles the glucose that they might have run out of. And so those sports drinks with a high glycemic index are helpful during the event, as long as it's appropriate to drink them. It might slow you down to stop and drink, but it's important to get the fluids, not just the sugars, in. And then finally, after the event, you will have depleted all your muscle stores of carbohydrate. If you've been going for long enough and hard enough, there's nothing left in your liver, there's nothing left in your muscle cells for as in the way of fuel. So we have to restock. And there is evidence in the scientific literature that a high glycemic index source of carbohydrate is most helpful if you want to restock stock fast. So perhaps you've got a second event coming up. Maybe you did one event in the morning and you've got to do another one in the afternoon. Well, and then a high glycemic index carbohydrate is appropriate. So your sports drinks might be useful in this context, but so will your typical high glycemic index carbohydrates, most breads, most breakfast cereals, most varieties of potatoes and rice have a high glycemic index.
Fantastic classification of it, and you're really giving a schedule of using this support system, especially for high performances. I need to mention that on the fourth part of your book, you diligently put tables of all these classifications, how to use this system, condensed tables and very comprehensive tables. So it's extremely useful and very clearly defined instruction, as I mentioned before, book becoming literally part of your life. You mentioned this sport activities, and I would say that the same frankly goes for the artistic performance, because even though it's not as apparent for the audience, but it is a highly athletic challenge to give a performance or to be a conductor or just to be in a stage, period. This is a very challenging, demanding athletically and mentally performance. So I would interpret your answers just as comprehensive for that type of artistic performances and goals as purely athletic ones. Yes,
that's absolutely right. There is a lot of research actually on how you get the best out of someone in maths tests, and there are lots of studies in children showing that if they've had breakfast and the breakfast contains carbohydrates, then they do better on tests than they do if they've missed breakfast altogether. And there are studies which show that a low glycemic index carbohydrate breakfast is an advantage over the high glycemic index breakfast. And interestingly, they've done these studies not just in children, they've done them in elderly people as well, elderly people with Alzheimer's disease, as well as people without mental issues. They've also done them in animals, and they can test an animal's intelligence, for example, by looking at how fast they learn a maze and how quickly they can find their way out of a maze after they've learned it. And the same findings are evident in the animal studies. A low glycemic index meal is an advantage for learning compared to a high glycemic index meal.
You know, it's interesting. While I was reading your book, I had my own browsing, and of course, one will think about development of the civilization, and not to derail and take much of the focus from the book and from your accomplishments. I was reading some time ago how indeed the transformation and that process was a problem for the food, and how we unfortunately had to find and struggle the balance between quantity and the quality, how it really took its curve from Stone Age to our present days during the Paleolithic hunting, for example, people instinctively felt how much of the fuel and energy they have to use in order to get a certain amount of nourishment, whether it's hunting or some other ways, but it was so much more balanced. And now we really have to exercise our knowledge, and we have to come back to the roots and remember that sweet sugar can be sweet friend, or it can be a sweet enemy as well. So I certainly feel that your book has, to me frankly, non-controversial message. I know that you probably had some resistance because a number of years ago people felt that it's just a fancy science. And I know in this country there was a resistance, but then it was such a tremendous, unbeatable evidence. And you're certainly one of the great founder of this evidence. And your book, New Glucose Revolution, is definitely tremendous food for thought. And that thought should be nourished with a good food. Jenny, for the remaining time, I wanted to ask you a little bit about yourself. Whatever you're comfortable to share with us, we'd like to know what kind of a person behind this brilliant scientist and what group your thoughts particularly around this research. What made you today so prominently, rightfully so famous, and so incredibly enthusiastically focused on the issues which we discussed?
What, so you're asking me to tell you a little bit about my life, are you?
Correct. And I piled everything in one question because I wanted to know, yes, about your life, and also what formed your focus in this particularly sharply relevant issue of this science and this dietary guidance.
All right. Well, I follow my own guidelines. I walk the talk is what I say. I grew up with a mum and a grandmother who were interested in food and how it affected their bodies. They were interested in good food, and I think that influenced me to study nutrition. So when I finished school, I did a science degree that focused as a major on food science. And so I learned how the food industry works. I learned how the chemistry of food is important. And then I studied nutrition as a PhD, and I studied how Aboriginal children, Australian Aboriginal children, were growing. Particularly in Australia, we have a group of children that are disadvantaged because of their Indigenous background. So we were able to show that a milk that was lactose hydrolyzed was helpful for these children, helped them grow faster, particularly if they've had some kind of gastrointestinal infection in the recent past. But that spurred my interest in Aboriginal foods. So Australian Aboriginal people, 200 years ago, they were Stone Age people who lived a hunter-gathering existence. And their life was a window into how all human beings led their lives before the advent of agriculture. So these people were hunter-gatherers. Everything, they didn't grow any plants in monoculture. They didn't settle down in villages. They lived by hunting and gathering. So one of my first projects was to analyze the foods in these Aboriginal diets, their natural native foods. And it was absolutely fascinating to see what they ate. They ate quite a lot of protein. Hunting was a significant part of their lives. And it wasn't just about hunting, you know, big animals like kangaroos. The women killed little animals, little things we call goannas, and turkeys and birds, and collected lots of plant foods, lily pads and what we call bush tomatoes and bush bananas. Anyway, we analyzed all these foods and we could see that their nutrient composition was different to that of modern cultivated foods. So it gave us this insight into what humans should be eating these days to help prevent these chronic diseases that you talked about earlier. But Lena, something that I would like to tell your listeners is that I, as a young child, I had perfect hearing. But by the time I was a teenager, my hearing had started to decline. And by the age of 25, I wore two powerful hearing aids. And my hearing, unfortunately, continued to decline to the point where I lost the hearing completely in one ear by the time I was about 45, and I was struggling to hear at all with the other ear because it was significantly impaired. But I was lucky because in Australia they have pioneered a form of hearing for people that are severely, profoundly deaf called cochlear implants. And cochlear implants are not hearing aids in the traditional sense. A cochlear implant is something that requires an operation where a small electrode is inserted in the cochlea, which is the hearing organ of the brain. So the reason I can talk to you today on radio without seeing you, I can't see your mouth or can't lip read, is because of I have these two cochlear implants. And these days in Australia and many other places around the world, children that are born deaf are given two cochlear implants before they're 1 year of age. And these children grow up speaking normally. They learn instruments to play instruments beautifully, and they live normal lives thanks to this new technology.
I cannot thank you enough to learn about this and the fact that you share this with us. Be very frankly with you, I learned this from you in our prior communication, but I just wanted to be thoughtful and I wasn't sure if you indeed will be comfortable to talk about this on the air, but I wanted to thank you for your eloquence, your sincerity, and such caring explanation what you had and what a fantastic hope for other people who would have the same medical issue. I cannot imagine a better conclusion to our program because I wanted to thank you for being such an incredibly brilliant scientist, but also exclusively fantastic person who has power of thought, who overcame with a tremendous amount of willpower and determination this physical handicap, and now has absolutely fullest life with such a tremendous success. I wanted to remind our listeners that I had an exclusive interview with Professor Jenny Brent Miller, who is a professor of the University of Sydney in Australia. And the last few remaining seconds, Jenny, if you like to pronounce your website to open continuation of all our communication with you, please do so before I will say final goodbye to you.
Thank you, Lena. Thank you. My website is glycemicindex.com, and I'll spell glycemic index. It's glycemicindex.com. And on that website, there's a free searchable database. Just enter the name of the food, and if it's been tested, then it will be there on the website. I encourage all the listeners to contact their food companies. If they can't find the glycemic index of the food, then they should contact consumer relations or the dietitian that works for that company and let them know that they'd like to have the glycemic index of that food. And thanks to that approach in Australia, we know the glycemic index of almost every carbohydrate food sold in Australia. But thank you so much, Lena, for having me on your program. I've been delighted to be here, to be able to have this opportunity to talk about the subject that I'm passionate about. I hope that the parents and the children will gain from what we've been talking about. And I admire you because of all the work that you do with children, disadvantaged children especially, as well as bringing music to their lives. So thank you again, Lena.
Thank you, and I would not say goodbye. I would say until soon, and I am certainly very, very profoundly thankful that you found the time. With all my warmest wishes, I hope we will stay in touch.
Thank you, Lena. Thank you again. Definitely.
And that was my another addition to Lena Life. I'm Lena Miremond with my warmest wishes to all of you to improve your knowledge, to be more informed about the diet, to make your sugar intake really very, very sweet experience. Until next week, with all my best to all of you. That was Lena Life. I'm Lena Miremond.